nothing sexier than voting on a hot summer day. Be sure to vote in the 40th Provincial General Election, Tuesday, May 14th. For more information, go to elections.bc.ca. First I say no, I got some plans for tonight, and then I stop and say,
good evening. I'm Ira Nadell, and I want to welcome everyone to another episode of UBC Arts on Air. It's a program of profiles, discussions, and debates with UBC Arts faculty, students, and even administrators. This evening, Adam Frank is our guest, and his special project, Radio Free Stein, rather remarkable title, Adam. Welcome. And let's begin with that title. What is Radio Free Stein?
Hi, Ira. Thanks for having me here. Radio Free Stein is a project to render as many of Gertrude Stein's plays into radio form as possible. So she wrote about 80 plays, and not that many of them have reached the stage. So I'm interested in seeing what happens when you can sonically stage them, in collaboration with some composers as well.
Well, of course, Stein is known as a fairly impenetrable essayist and autobiographer. How is she as a playwright? I'm kind of surprised to learn about this.
Yeah, so Stein wrote in almost every genre that you can imagine. And she started writing plays in 1914 or so, like right at the beginning of World War I. And she continued writing plays for the rest of her career up until the end of her life.
But was she successful as a playwright? I mean, were they staged in Paris or in even the United States when she visited in 1934, 35?
So the most famous of her theatrical works is Four Saints in Three Acts, an opera to be sung with music by Virgil Thompson. And that was staged in the 30s when she visited the U.S., and it was very successful. It was surprisingly successful. So successful that stores would kind of feature puns on the title of Four Saints in Three Acts on Broadway.
That's pretty remarkable. But tell me, how did you become involved with this aspect of her career? Because there's so many dimensions to Gertrude Stein.
Yeah. So I've been reading Stein for a long time and teaching Stein, which is a challenge. And it had come to me pretty early that one of the best ways to understand Stein is to read her aloud. The problem with plays, with her plays, is that it's hard to read them aloud alone. So I had offered a seminar where I'd offered one idea. If you wanted to write about the plays, I said to the students, see how you could imagine staging one of these plays. Get together in a small group and just creatively figure out how you could possibly stage this. So Stein's plays are very challenging in that there often are no clear demarcations between stage directions and dialogue. The titles are not in any particular order. It's very hard to know whether it's a poem you're reading or a play sometimes. And so the person who's interested in staging it has to do a lot of work to figure out how to imagine producing it, basically.
And you think that radio is the most successful way of doing this?
Not for all of them, but for the early plays, one Stein critic labels the early plays conversation plays. They often feature kind of quick dialogue between a number of characters. And it's almost like you're overhearing a kind of telephone call or a gossip session, something like that. And so it does seem like primarily an audio experience.
So if I went to the theater because it says tonight a play by Gertrude Stein, would I be bored and get up and leave because there were no gunshots, there was no sword fighting, there was no kind of Tennessee Williams element to it? What do you think how would an audience respond to a Gertrude Stein play?
Depends who's directing it. You can do a lot of different things with a Stein play, and it all depends on how you can, as it were, motivate your decisions. So some plays have been staged with quite a lot of action. I saw a Robert Wilson production of oh, now I'm forgetting the title. It's my favorite one. Dr. Faustus Lights the Lights, which was staged with a German acrobatic troupe and a light show. And it was extremely entertaining and very engrossing.
It sounds a little bit like Tom Stoppard. And I wonder what Stoppard, you know, thinks of Stein's plays. It's a curious thing. Okay, so she's got this dramatic career. Were these plays produced in France at all?
Not much. Hardly any plays were produced in her lifetime, except for the Four Saints and Three Acts One. Most of the performances of her work tended to be performances with music. She was curious about whether that needed to be so. She herself wondered why people wanted to put music to them. But people have been putting music to her dramatic work since the beginning. John Cage, is some of his earliest work in the early 30s are settings for Stein's work. And that continues through the 40s and 50s. And in the 60s, during a sort of revival of Stein's work, there's a bunch of musical adaptations.
Okay. So can you speak more precisely about this project? And I know you have a performance planned on the 3rd of May, I believe. What play and how did you choose it?
Okay. So the project Radio Free Stein is basically, I read a whole bunch of plays at the beginning and just took notes to see which of these would make any sense on radio. And one of them that just jumped out at me was called For the Country Entirely, A Play in Letters. And she wrote this in 1916 when she and Alice Toklas were in Mallorca. They had left Paris during the war because of the air raids and because of the coal shortages. And they went to Mallorca where they had previously vacationed, and they hung out with some Americans and English expatriates. And there they basically figured out how to be there. Were they waiting out the war? Were they going to find a way to participate? It was unclear what was going on. And that's when she started writing a bunch of plays. And it seemed that her early playwriting at that point is in some pretty interesting, if not entirely clear, relation to the war at that point. So I became interested in just adapting one of these, the one that seemed funniest and most interesting to me, as a first go.
Does this play have acts and scenes in it and characters entering and leaving? Again, I'm thinking more of witnessing the production rather than listening to the production. Would I have something to see?
Well, I'm not doing a rather regular theatrical staging, so I haven't blocked it out exactly. But it does have four characters, the way I understand it. It does have acts and scenes, although the very first act, the scenes are called chapters. So it is a play in letters in the sense that it's, as it were, a dramatic version of an epistolary novel. So she's kind of experimenting with the idea, well, if you can write a novel in letter form, why not write a play in letter form? And of course, as she is in sort of the semi-voluntary exile, she's occupying herself with letter writing quite a lot of the time, getting information from friends, and letters become very, very important for her to think about, especially thinking about how women could participate in war. So letter writing becomes this fascination for her. One of the things that she does while she's in Mallorca is she reads aloud, she says, all the letters of Queen Victoria aloud to Alice. And she becomes very interested, it seems to me, in how it is that Queen Victoria's letters inhabit this sort of semi-political space. That's also a kind of space of women's writing. So I think that she's interested in experimenting with that in this play.
What happens in this play? I mean, can you say this is the action that takes place, or what happens?
It's funny. It's a funny question because her very first play is titled What Happened? A Play. And Stein's whole idea for plays is how can I depict a set of experiences without telling a story? So stories, she says, we all read stories. We all tell stories all the time. That's not interesting, according to her. What she wants to do is get at the essence of what happened without actually using narrative. And I think for her, what plays are fundamentally are portraits of groups. They're portraits of a number of individuals engaging in some set of relations with one another. And dialogue or speech is the primary activity of these individuals. And so what results is less a sense of what happened than a sense of the relations that the group have with one another and how those relations change over the course of the play.
So would you say one of the larger goals of the entire project is perhaps to, I don't want to say remake, but at least expand the idea of what Gertrude Stein does and, in a sense, who she is? Because, frankly, if you mention Gertrude Stein to students or even to, you know, scholars, they're going to quickly say Autobiography of Alice B. Toklas and several of her essay lectures. Beyond that, I think, and Tender Buttons, it's a bit difficult to come up with a clear-cut I don't want to say bibliography, but list of masterworks or masterpieces. And she did a lecture called What is a Masterpiece or What are Masterpieces? So is part of what you're trying to do expand the identity of Stein?
Well, Stein's identity, that's an interesting way to put it. It's less that I want to expand her identity than I want to make available more of her work in some form that people can enjoy and also learn something from. I mean, I learn from reading Stein, not all the time. I mean, I struggle with it and I go back and forth with it. But it's always an experience of some interesting and tangible kind. And it's hard to get people into the frame of mind where they can let themselves have that experience. And I'm thinking that the Radio Free Stein Project is essentially has that as its goal, making available this form of writing that she engaged in that is productive, not just for her, and but also for drama. I mean, her notion of landscape theater has been incredibly influential for experimental and avant-garde non-naturalist theater. It's been really central. But her plays haven't been. And so I'm wondering why. I'm wondering why it is that her, as it were, play theory or play poetics has been so influential and her plays themselves haven't been, but how can we reinterpret her plays so that we can integrate the theory with the practice, as it were?
So is it fair but simple to simply declare Stein a performer in every possible sense of the word? So when she writes prose, she's performing. When she gives lectures, she's performing. When she is writing these plays, it's another expression of performance?
Yes.
And you're hesitating.
I'm hesitating. I'm hesitating because this is a very tricky problem or problematic that I think people in our field have been struggling with for the last 20 years, which is, on the one hand, this idea of performance, which has been so important for many of us, and on the other hand, this more linguistic idea of the performative. And these two ideas seem like they ought to go together, and yet people have been trying and failing to make them go together in a convincing way. And actually, if I'm hoping that this project lets me revisit that problem in a way that gets somewhere. So she is certainly, her writing is definitely performative, and I'm wondering what happens if you take that approach to the plays themselves.
Now, are there other figures, other writers, either in a European tradition or in an English tradition, that you see analogous to Stein and what she's doing?
It's a really good question. I mean, so I just taught a class for the first time trying to teach myself modernist theater, basically. And we read Ibsen, Chekhov, Brecht, Stein, Beckett. It's a blast. And it occurs to me that there has to be a relation between Stein and Brecht that can be unfolded. And even like almost like between Chekhov and Brecht, something about, so Raymond Williams talks about Chekhov's dialogue as the attempt to create a group portrait. Actually, he uses that idea of the dialogue that's fragmented and in pieces and people not ever completing their sentences and some people completing each other's thoughts. And he says that what results is this idea of a group, the feeling of group. And I think that's actually what Stein is up to, coming from a very different angle, but with the same kind of idea. And not interested in the kind of alienation effect that Brecht is interested in, but still interested in how it is that theater can enable new experience, new thoughts.
One of the other distinguishing qualities of Stein is her persistent, identity as an American. Mm. And she's always talking about this American identity. Is there a powerful American element in these plays, or is it something that she at last puts aside for more formal and, what shall we say, dramatic reasons?
Another good question. So again, the Stein critic, Jane Bowers, whose work has been most important for thinking about Stein's plays, locates her not in a kind of a European avant-garde tradition of shock, which is in some ways anti-language, but in an American tradition coming from Emerson, William James, one that's centered around the question of the contemporary experience. How can you adequately occasion a contemporary experience in a work of representation? So I think in that way she's definitely in that tradition. And so John Cage is another person. I think Andy Warhol is in this tradition. So I definitely see her as part of a tradition of American writers. And I have a book that's going to be coming out next year called Transferential Poetics from Poe to Warhol, in which there are two chapters on Stein. So it locates her in that kind of tradition.
It would be surprising if she didn't incorporate that American element, given the persistence and kind of immersion in Americanness that appears throughout her work. So that's very interesting. Well, we're kind of running out of time, but I do have to ask you, do you have similar projects in mind? I know you're immersed in Stein, but if you could look a few years down the road, would there be another figure that you can see exploring in the same way, or essentially, and you're still hesitant about saying it, you've had it. After Gertrude Stein, I'm going to do Whitman or something.
Well, I'm sort of at the beginning of this project, and I just got this short grant. That's a 4 or 5 year grant. So I have to say, it's hard enough for me to predict what I'm going to do tomorrow, never mind 5 years from now. So Stein is pretty occupying. I've got some other projects that I'm working on that have more to do with my research in affect theory that aren't directly connected. I mean, I could sort of bridge it for you if you needed it bridged, but I don't think that's where the question's coming from.
No, I was interested more in drama and the orality of drama and the oral dimension that you're developing in such an intriguing and interesting way.
So, I mean, the aesthetic question that's really motivating me here is, and I'm working with composers specifically, because I want to ask the question, can you create audio experiences where the music and the words are, as it were, on the same level, that the words aren't subordinate to the music and the music isn't subordinated to the words, but that isn't song. So what does that look like? And, you know, I'm calling it melodrama in its old sense, in its late 18th century sense of music that creates a kind of a setting for words, and then words create a setting for music that becomes part of a lot of different cultural forms in the 19th century. And then, of course, it's around all the time now because music is our setting for everything. So I want to see if I can do a version of that that's satisfying for the composers that I'm working with.
You hesitate to use the word opera.
Yes.
Why? And yet she uses, yes. She refers to her work as opera, some of it.
Yes. Well, partly because I'm not dealing with singing, and opera is sung. So I'm avoiding the word opera, although there is an American tradition of opera. I'm thinking about Robert Ashley and his works, where he sort of says everything is opera. Everything is opera now. And I think he's just using the word opera to mean work in that way. Yeah, I'm avoiding opera just probably because of its associations with that European tradition.
You mentioned John Cage earlier. What about Philip Glass? Is there an association here, or if you're trying to construct a kind of line of development or at least connection from Gertrude Stein forward in terms of American composers, would Philip Glass be part of that?
Probably, although I think that minimalism is not necessarily the place to take Stein. She's certainly not a minimalist writer. So again, Ashley is the person I think of most, although... And then some of the other experimenters from that moment, Alvin Lucier, a number of other experimental composers from that moment. Glass, I think, is in there, but he's sort of going off in his other in another direction.
So I want to end, Adam, with a quick list from you for people who recognize the name Gertrude Stein, but frankly haven't read very much Gertrude Stein. Can you cite a couple of titles of things that you think would be a good introduction to her world? Not necessarily the plays, but I think she's important, but I don't know anything about her.
Mm-hmm. The autobiography is still the best place to start. I mean, the autobiography is a blast. It's very funny, and it's very charming. Which is what she most wanted it to be. The lectures in America are quite great, and they continue to be provocative. In terms of writing, there's so much. You could go back to the very, very early novel of hers, which is published under the title QED, or Things as They Are. If you want to get a sense of the relation that she has to the sort of late 19th century writers like Henry James or kind of the realist writers, she's writing in a mode that before she turns to a kind of so-called repetitive style. Tender Buttons still works extremely well as a way to think about that sort of second part of her career.
You haven't mentioned The Making of Americans.
Yes, well, if you want to read a long novel, I really encourage reading The Making of Americans if you get into it. There's a guy named Gregory Lehner who's actually a grad student at University of Washington, but I first knew him because on the Ubu Sound website, they had posted him reading the entire novel, the long version, the 1,000-page version. And he said it was such a trip that he had to find ways to keep himself interested. And at a certain point, he starts chanting. He can't do anything except start a cantorial style chanting of it. It's a pretty psychedelic experience.
Well, it takes us back to the beginning where you said that Stein essentially is an oral, you know, writer, and perhaps the best way to approach her, as indeed with late Joyce, particularly Finnegan's Wake, is through sound, is through reading Stein out loud. Terrific. Adam, thank you so much for joining us today. It's a wonderful introduction to your project, Radio Free Stein, and indeed Gertrude Stein. And thanks to our listeners for tuning in to another UBC Arts on Air. And stay tuned for future broadcasts. Very good.
Thanks, Ira. That was really fun.
That was fun.
This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.